Do you ever see a successful woman on your feed or in a magazine and think, wow, it must be nice to have it so easy? Well, think again. Behind that glossy cover or smiling face is a ton of hard work, countless failures, and endless learning experiences. I'm Rebecca Minkoff, and I'm here to tell you that success isn't a walk in the park. It takes grit, resilience, and a willingness to take risks. That's why I created Superwoman, a podcast that peels back the varnish and gets into the nitty-gritty of what it takes to make it as a woman in today's world. From luminaries and game changers to women you've never heard of but should, this podcast is here to inspire you to take your next leap, no matter how daunting it may seem. We'll explore the sacrifices these women have made, the highs and lows they've experienced, and the lessons they've learned along the way. So if you're ready to be inspired and learn from some of the most successful women out there, join me on Superwomen. Together, we'll uncover the stories behind the successes and prove that with hard work, determination, and a little bit of luck, anything is possible. Hey everyone, you're listening to Superwomen. Today's guest is Vanessa Barboni-Halit, and she is the founder and CEO of Another Tomorrow, an end-to-end sustainable apparel company and platform for discovery and action committed to transparency and a circular economy. Launched in 2020, Another Tomorrow is a ready-to-wear brand operating at the intersection of sustainability, ethics, and design. She has built a foundation of community, transparency, and organic scarcity, with empathy for the earth and its inhabitants as the common thread. And every decision is guided by a value system based on three pillars: human, animal, and environmental welfare. I was beyond impressed when I interviewed Vanessa at how she thought about every single detail that would not only go into the garment, but the responsibility we have as creators to ensure a more sustainable future. Take a listen. So here we go. Vanessa, welcome. I'm so excited to chat with you today. And I've been such a fan for a long time. So I'm honored to have you.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here and some amazing footsteps to be following.
So you have been quoted in many places, Vogue. You have an incredible following. You've broken through at a time when I feel like it's really hard for designers to cut through the noise. And I would love to start with your vision for Another Tomorrow. What gave you the idea? And then we'll get into more after that.
Oh gosh, it was, you know, it's really been a beautiful accident that makes a lot more sense in hindsight, I think, than it did at the time. And I always kind of go back now to my childhood, and I'll try and make, you know, what is ultimately a long story quite short. But, you know, I grew up in the Midwest at a really kind of crazy time in the 80s, Midwest and Rust Belt. And my dad was a professor, my mom was an artist, and my dad was also a really early technologist. And I kind of grew up at just this wild kind of intersection of disciplines. And I had a really kind of optimistic view of the world. And, you know, some of my formative influences were sitting kind of cross-legged with the whole Earth catalog on my lap, which I still come back to. So it was a really beautiful way to grow up. And at the same time, you know, I really also had a very firsthand kind of experience with all of the ills of capitalism. You know, it was a time when, you know, what was happening in the Great Lakes and kind of this post-industrial area and the Rust Belt was really, really problematic. I saw really good jobs leave the second town that I lived in, and just the bottom literally fell out of the culture. I mean, it really, like, the drug utilization, the crime. So I really saw, you know, what just happened, like the fabric of a society when the economic viability really changed. And I mean, that just gave me a really clear sense that the system as is was not working for everyone in really, really clear ways. And so those were some of my formative influences. I then went out to Berkeley thinking I was potentially going to be an architect, and that was going to be sort of the way that I bring all these things together. Although my dad had forced me to take coding in high school, so maybe there was a little tech bone in my body. But, you know, my mom passed away my freshman year of college, and I just did like a huge pivot, ended up on Wall Street. That's a whole other story. Spent 15 years.
Oh my
years
gosh. Of, yeah. 15 years on Will? On
yeah.
Wall Street? Oh my gosh.
15 years. Initially as an options trader, which was quite interesting. I mean, I thought banks were tellers, like, you know, you go through the drive through and you get the little tube. So yeah. An investment bank was like the furthest thing from my even understanding of existence. So it was pretty wild. So yeah, I was in emerging markets trading for 15 years, but I left a couple of times. One to do a degree in energy and environmental policy, kind of trying to constantly figure out how I was going to bring my day job into something relevant for the world. And long story short, after building a bunch of businesses there over 15 years and really appreciating that opportunity, I felt it was really deeply time after I made MD to really focus on the next chapter of my career about bringing something purposeful into the world. And I started to do some early stage investing in climate tech and material science. And I really felt that, you know, what gets funded is what gets built, and there needed to be a different vision for the future. So I took a sabbatical from that job. They were really wonderful. And I thought I was going to stay in finance, and I thought I was just going to move into ESG and sustainability. And little did I know, I completely tripped down the rabbit hole of the kind of beautiful horror show that is the fashion industry.
It's a perfect description for right? it. It is a beautiful horror show.
It's a beautiful horror show. It's like the scourge of the earth, and it's amazing at the same time. And you know, I was really, you know, I like to think of myself as kind of a well-educated researcher, but also a consumer. And I found that I actually knew remarkably little about fashion. And initially, I just thought I'd try and, you know, shop better, shop more responsibly. And I really just, I couldn't find much as a consumer. And I also just, I didn't see this kind of beacon of vision in the industry that I felt like could be a roadmap for the future. And so the more I dug and peeled back the layers of the onion, I spent my entire sabbatical researching what ultimately became Another Tomorrow, and really built it as an idea of what a sustainable, both, you know, financially and environmentally and ethically, vision of the industry could be. And I knew one person in all of fashion at the time, which makes it just that much more insane. And I look back with just immense, immense gratitude for all of the warm reception and help and love and support that we've gotten on the journey. So there you have it. That's the long story short-ish.
Wow. I mean, it's impressive that you knew one person. I feel like there is still some gatekeeping that exists in this industry. And I think that clearly you've broken through the gates and found success. I'd love to touch on how hard it can be to have a sustainable brand. And I know for us, in the ways that we have integrated sustainability very imperfectly, whether it's in our apparel, there's a portion that is, or our handbags, you know, we've eliminated plastic for the most part, except for one part. But it is so much harder than anyone ever imagined, and so much more expensive. I'll share this quickly. When we tried to remove plastic hangers, you know, from our garments, we were told by our department stores that they would charge us back $4 per hanger to switch it from cardboard to plastic. And so we couldn't obviously absorb that pricing. So I think people talk about it and no one knows how hard it is for it to start from the beginning and then end at the customer. So I'd love for you to share, you know, what you have to go through to produce the garments and make sure that, you know, that you keep your vision alive. And then how do you even then make sure you can sell it at a price that people are like, okay, I'll pay this.
No, it's exceptionally hard. And I think that also flows through to even the end consumer really understanding it, because there's so much complexity. I mean, where I often start is just the fact that, you know, fashion is either like a petrochemical, i.e. plastic product, or it's an agricultural product. And so, you know, if you take a like through the lens of an agricultural product, you've got all the complexities of almost like food and then all the processing that comes thereafter. And so, you know, early on, the second two people I brought in as a team into the team were really experts in this space. And they helped me really develop a very clear framework for decision making around animal, environmental, and human welfare. And I felt very strongly that we had to tackle all three of those. And I got a lot of pushback around that of like, isn't that too much? You know, shouldn't you pick and choose? But I felt like if we were starting really from a blank slate, that you had to take all of the embodied knowledge as you came to that blank slate. And you know, one of the first things that we did initially, somewhat accidentally, is we decided to build our supply chains from the farm up as much as we possibly could. And it started actually with wool. And my initial idea is like, wouldn't it be a beautiful thing in the wool context if we could build an entire made in America, ethical, you know, regenerative wool supply chain, and knowing that wasn't going to be everything that was in the collection, but that would be one thing. And in one of the first meetings actually were some sheep farmers here in the States. And we very quickly learned that, okay, like actually the fiber quality in the States is actually not the super fine merino wool that you actually need. And even if you got it, the whole intermediate supply chain has been decimated. So long story short, our wool supply chain is a good emblematic kind of example of this. But we literally bought wool directly from these farmers in Tasmania, which is pretty insane. I first met them via Skype through an organization called Fibershed, and our first head of sustainability, Natalie Grillen, who's an amazing human being. And we found that we could buy the type of fiber and with our sustainability and ethics framework directly from these farmers, female farmers, which was super, super cool. Then we had to say, okay, all of a sudden we've got this wool, but then what the heck are we going to do about it? So we were traipsing around Italy, talking to mills, and the mills had to meet our chemical standards, water standards, quality of the fabric standards, design standards, and then say, hey, you know, we don't even exist as a company yet, but would you please be willing to use our wool? And we got no, 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 no. And then we got one yes for like 10,000 meters. Now, you and I both know, like, that's a lot of fabric, especially for a company that doesn't even exist yet.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a no. And so we kept going back to them and kept going back to them. And I think it was probably just easier at some stage to say yes. And they have become our strategic partner for all of our wool, all of our wovens, all of our knitwear. And then we had to find factories to manufacture the garments that paid a living wage, that were expert in their craft. And we managed to do that. So that was just one supply chain. So basically you're talking about, you know, everything from soil health, carbon sequestration, animal welfare, emissions in the logistics process, water, chemicals, and energy and wages. And that's your supply chain. And then we decided that we wanted to digitize everything so that the customer could visualize that supply chain and also use it as an authentication mechanism to sell it back to us through our resale. So yeah, it's a little bit wild. And then of course the product has to, you know, the customer, let's just say 1 out of 10 people care, right? So that the product has to be exquisite and really stand on its own, independent of all of that, work. But it's the only reason why we exist.
Overwhelming.
Yeah, it's insane. It's insane. But then the beautiful thing has been that, you know, that all sounds really hard in hindsight. I actually don't even think about it anymore. Like that just is like water under a bridge so long ago. But we've been able to really develop that now at scale, which is really, really exciting. And now the things that we're dealing with are, you know, we're desperate to bring certain material science solutions to life. And that's like crazy hard, and actually properly commercializing that is like the time scales are really long. I think, you know, starting from a blank slate makes it a heck of a lot easier. And it's our goal to hopefully make it easier for others to do what we did, because there's no point in, you know, reinventing the wheel.
Yeah. And I'm sure it obviously helps you if more and more people enter into this mindset and field, because the costs would plummet in a good way.
Yes, if absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I was on Delta and I watched that film. I'm sure you know the name of the documentary, but it basically went through the cotton industry and the fabric and fast fashion and, you know, the pesticides in India and the birth defects that these children have because it's in the water. And I was just like, you can't come out of watching something like that or hearing, you know, about, like you said, an area in the Rust Belt decimated and feel like you have to change. You know, I went right back to my apparel team. I was like, for the love of God, we have to change. You know, we have to like get rid of all this stuff. And it's not an easy feat. Did you ever feel discouraged?
Oh yeah. I mean, there are so many things, there's so many things along the path, but I think what I found is that it's rarely the thing that you think is going to be the issue that's, you know, that's the issue. You know, we launched 6 weeks before COVID. That was so not part of the business plan, you know? So there were tons of, you know, pivots we had to make on the back of that. And we also had to be more patient than, you know, we wanted. So that was a big one.
Was that scary that you launched and probably had a quite sizable investment and then COVID hit and people were like not sure for a while? Yeah.
Yeah. And we had no demand visibility, right? So as a brand also that only wanted to produce things that we felt really needed to exist in the world, not knowing what anybody needed or when they would need it was just a very bizarre thing. So we really slowed things down tremendously that first year. And as a gal coming out of finance who's like got the need for speed, which is something that I've had to really wean myself off of to a degree, that was also uncomfortable, you know, because you thought you were going to be able to do X and you felt like, okay, you had to like tweak things. So that was tricky. You know, a really big one, you know, one of our, my main, you know, early partners in the business passed away, like, and that was like just a devastating situation. And, you know, so, so many curveballs, but, you know, it wasn't the supply chain thing. It was the pandemic. It wasn't, you know, the demand situation. It was, you know, the death of somebody really deeply important to me personally and to the business. And so you just never know what it's going to be. And I think what I've tried to really look for, and this has been a mindset shift, honestly, is the patterns of resilience instead of the patterns of pain and problems. And it just changes like your pattern recognition and how you think about responding to things, because there will always be something.
Always. I think what always. I find the most is I'm still shocked that there's still issues of things you couldn't make up. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it's almost been 20 years. And I'm still like, wait, why did that happen?
Totally. So, yeah. Totally.
So one of the things that I'm always surprised by is you get all this data and surveys like Gen Z cares about sustainability, but then they're the most avid consumers of Shein and, you know, what is it? That store that sells everything for $15 and it's one size fits all. That's like the trending. And you're just like, wait a second. I don't think they care about the climate. No one cares if we put sustainability on our labeling, you know, for the pieces that we have. So why does the data say that? And how can we get more people to care? Because in my personal life, I'm, you know, I compost, I recycle, I think about what I'm purchasing. And in my company, I do as much as I can. But I feel like this younger generation, either we're being lied to with these surveys or, you know, I'm just curious your thoughts after seeing this landscape.
Well, I have a 13-year-old stepdaughter, so I get to see both sides of this in stark relief. And I feel you. And I think that there's really, there are huge, huge tensions in all of it. But I think, you know, for me, it comes back to kind of what you referenced about seeing that documentary, right? Like, I think a lot of this idea and concept around sustainability remains kind of intellectual. And insofar as it remains intellectual, like that's not what drives our everyday choices. And I think it really is creating that sense of connection in a way that people can relate to that will ultimately change behaviors. And it's tricky because I think this industry is so incredibly opaque. But if, you know, if you have the opportunity like I did, you know, to be there on the farm, literally, with these farmers, not only do you have a much deeper understanding of the real issues, but also the idea that any of that goes to waste when it is so difficult to produce in the first place, makes you kind of physically sick. Now, obviously, it's very difficult to recreate that experience, but I do think about storytelling through that lens of like, how do you recreate that sense of connection? And sometimes it's the brand that's doing it, but sometimes it's also actually supporting a documentary or it's supporting storytelling that somebody else is doing or it's supporting policy. But I think in this sort of like business as usual culture, it's a pretty extreme leap to think that all of a sudden like this next generation is going to save us. And part of the reason why re-commerce, like resale, is so popular is that it's one of the few ways that you can actually make the more responsible choice and it's cheaper. Yeah. And it's kind of cool and you've got this sort of like hunt. But human psychology is crazy powerful and this next generation is not like going to magically bail us out. And I think the more that I hear people anticipating that, it's kind of just like passing the buck. I mean, we've got to do the hard work. What we see in our business is that the key drivers for purchases, and it shifts a little bit from year to year, but it's usually the hierarchy is about the same. It's quality is number one, design is number two, and sustainability is number three out of about 10 different things. And I think for us, like, sustainability is very much like a retention driver. It's what keeps people coming back. It's what makes people feel part of the family. But if you don't love the product, you're not going to buy it, nor should you. It's just going to sit in your closet, right? So we got a lot of work to do, but I think that creating that sense of connection back to like what these supply chains actually touch and who they touch is important, but it's certainly not enough.
Yeah. I hear you on the product. It doesn't matter if it's sustainable, if it's not beautiful.
No.
Yeah.
And I've bought my share of things that I bought out of like guilt or love for the mission, and they don't see the light of day that often, no. Which isn't so
they
great.
They look like the craft market that you purchased them at.
Yeah, basically.
So what is, throughout this process, what is a piece of advice you would love to pass on or that you learned the hard way to other people, either starting their own businesses or entering in and wanting to have a sustainable supply chain or just being a woman in business, frankly?
I mean, I'll say like networking community is like everything. I felt like such a lone ranger when I was in finance. I mean, I had, great friends and great colleagues, but I didn't have the same focus or intention around really like building community and building friendships. I also, moving into this space, like, just did not get this like founder to founder friendship. I was like, why is that such a thing? And I'm like, oh, totally get that. Cause it's like, there are very few people who've actually had the same lived experience. So I think that, for anyone looking to start a business, like, go get yourself some founder friends.
Yes.
I also really advise people to think through not just the idea, but what is the day to day of the work? And for me, it's like the one job you actually can't quit. You've got skin in the game. You've got investors that you really care deeply about and have a responsibility to. And so, don't just get romanced by the idea, like really think it through, map out like what you're committing to, and know that it's going to be, as you just said, it's been 20 years for you. Like, it's going to be a long ride. It can be a really important and meaningful ride, but you got to know what you're getting yourself into. And then just look for those, once you're in it, just, keep building that muscle of resilience. Keep building it and try and be vulnerable, ask for help. It took me way too long to learn how to ask for help. I was like so afraid to ask for help. And now I ask for help all the time. It's like the most amazing thing.
What was the catalyst that finally made you feel like, okay, I just got to get over this and ask?
I think it was being such a fish out of water and just knowing that I was never going to be the one with the best answers in the room, and recognizing that that was okay. And that it was fundamental to like the survival of the business is, just getting over your own ego and just, being ready and willing to bring in the person smarter than you, the person who knows the answer. And that's so freeing once you get there. It's beautiful.
I know, once you unleash the please help me, it's a relief instead of feeling like you have to figure it out all on your own.
Yeah, worst case scenario is no. Who cares?
Yeah. Yeah. So if someone, again, your breakthrough, especially to the higher end of fashion, whether it is Vogue or the retailers that you're in or going to be in, which we'll talk about, is less likely for a lot of people. So what do you credit that ability to sort of, you knew one person, how did you get to the Vogues, to, the best department store in the world, like, what do you credit that to?
I think it was some of the really early team members, honestly. We were able to build a group of people who were both really skilled and talented and experienced in the industry, who really wanted to be a part of this vision for the future. And so I think that, whether you're looking at team members or whether you're looking at investors, really finding people who are like energetically aligned and bring real excellence to the mission was really critical. That was critical with some of our early retailer relationships. On the press side, same thing, huge credit to Sarah Byworth, who first did our press. And also part of it is just actually knowing exactly what you want and what you think those early milestones are, and just being totally uncompromising and getting it. Because when you're hyper specific about, you know, I want it, like, this is what I want to accomplish, it just narrows your field of vision, I think, in a way that's really important. Does not by any stretch guarantee success. But I know that there are a lot of different directions we could have turned in the early days that probably would have led to, you know, different outcomes. But really, that the quality of that early team and the depth to which they cared and were willing to stick their necks out and, you know, make the call and make the recommendation was just huge. You know, you do not do this on your own by any stretch.
Yeah. I love that you say that, because I'm always fascinated by the rise of a brand and who were the early adopters of it. And it's so specific who those people are that other people then listen to, and then that, you know.
Oh, yeah. Natalie Kingham at Matches. I mean, forever love for her. I mean, we didn't even exist as a brand, and she bought the whole damn thing before we launched. And just so much love for her and the courage that took and the faith that took. And it made a big difference for us.
Yeah, for sure. So what do you have coming up that's exciting that people should look forward to?
Well, we're very excited to be bringing the brand more and more into the physical realm. And so we are launching this month with Selfridges. So really, really excited to be in Selfridges in the UK. We've been online with Bergdorf's for a while, but we will be there on the sixth floor in the month of April. So we're really excited for that too. And, you know, so a lot of these physical manifestations, you know, it's such a tactile product. We're so proud of, like, the quality and the craft and what we've created with these supply chains and really our opportunity to really connect with women wearing the product. So it's exciting.
That's awesome. And my last question for you, and I like to ask 99% of my guests, is there anything we'd be surprised to know about you?
Oh gosh. I'm really an introvert.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't come off as one at all.
I know. I'm really at heart, I'm really an introvert.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So how do you find it in yourself to pitch yourself, or when you're in these big rooms like a Matches, which for those listening is an incredibly gorgeous, I don't know, curator of products and fashion, and obviously has a lot of weight. Like, how do you find yourself, you know, in those rooms, especially like being an unknown?
You know, in smaller groups, it's always been sort of fine. And I'm really driven by the passion for what we're building. I also did manage introversion on a trading floor for 15 years. So I built some muscle memory and I do know how to raise my voice. Yeah, it's something I didn't even really know about myself, I think, until I got into this. And, you know, entrepreneurship is just such a window of personal exploration. And that was something that I really came to recognize. And one of our early advisors actually kind of called me out on it. She's like, you know, you're speaking all the time, but like, do you realize you're really like quite an introvert? I mean, a big cocktail party, I mean, I'd rather just hide under the table.
Okay, so I take it you're not out at all the soirees then. That
exists. Not as much as I should be.
Fair.
Yeah.
So where can everyone, I know you mentioned the two launches. Until then, just please tell us where everyone can buy and consume and see
your
product.
So anothertomorrow.co is our website, first and foremost. You can obviously find us on Instagram at anothertomorrow. Net-a-Porter has a beautiful selection of product as well. And as I mentioned, you know, on the floor very soon at Selfridges, Bergdorf, select Neiman Marcus locations, and some wonderful specialty stores throughout the US as well. But really honored to have this beautiful group of customers and community. So look forward to seeing folks. Yeah.
Well, I'm so impressed. It's incredible what you've built and how you've kept your integrity in throughout the way, and that, you know, there's no greenwashing, I can tell you, that you're doing.
It's hard work. It's an amazing team behind it. And if anyone wants any info on what we're doing or how we can make life easier, I have office hours monthly. Liz, our creative director, has office hours monthly. And there is a heap of info on sustainability on the site that hopefully folks can find interesting and useful.
Awesome. And how would people contact you regarding office hours?
There's a link on my LinkedIn profile.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Well, I might be requesting your time.
Go for it. I would love to talk more. I would be honored.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
I just wanted to thank you guys for listening to today's episode. I also want to ask you to rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts. I know it's a pain in the butt, but it actually helps with search and algorithms. So if you love this podcast, it is an easy way to get it more visible and out there. I also want you to follow me on Instagram at Rebecca Minkoff, at RM Superwomen, and be sure to check out my book, Fearless, The New Rules for Unlocking Creativity, Courage, and Success. Thank you again, and you will hear from me next week.